Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas are advised to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Please be seated. This morning, the court has three matters on its oral submission docket. In the order that we will hear them, they are Guadalupe Blanco River Authority versus Marvin Kraft Sr. from Hayes County and the 3rd Appellate District, Exxon Pipeline Company versus Daniel and Sandra Zwar from Fort Bend County and the 1st Appellate District, and Mission Petroleum Carriers Incorporated versus Roy Solomon from Jefferson County and the 9th Appellate District. In each of these matters, the court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument. The petitioner may reserve a portion of that time by advising the marshal of the court. Tapes of any of these arguments are available from our clerk for a nominal fee if you desire to have a record. We will complete these arguments before noon, and we will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each argument. We're now ready to hear from petitioner in Guadalupe Blanco versus Kraft.
May it please the court, Mr. Robert Gies, the present argument for the petition. Petitioner shall reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. This case involves the appraisal of a 30 by 4,600 foot strip in a condemnation proceeding, and the issue is whether the Dahlberg-Robinson-Gamble reliability standards applies to the appraisal testimony. The majority opinion of the Court of Appeals begins by recognizing, as it must, the Gamble versus Jack Williams Chevrolet provides that expert testimony must be relevant and reliable if it's to be admissible, and that the district court has a duty to act as a gatekeeper to ensure that that reliability decision is made before the testimony is presented to the jury. By the time the Court of Appeals gets to its holding, however, it has in essence read those requirements out of Texas jurisprudence, at least insofar as appraisal testimony in condemnation cases is concerned. The Court of Appeals majority concluded in the specific context of appraisal testimony that if one party is permitted to present evidence of market value, then the other should be allowed to present evidence based on its competing theory. Even though the comparable sales are allegedly based on the wrong assumptions and are not truly comparable, the perceived flaws in the testimony of the experts are matters properly to be tested in the crucible of adversarial proceedings. They are not the basis for truncating that process. In other words, according to the majority of the Court of Appeals, admit the evidence, notwithstanding the objections as to reliability of the experts' methodology, and let the jury, with the assistance, of course, of cross-examination and competing testimony, determine whether the testimony or which testimony is correct. And I would suggest that is exactly the opposite of what this court has ruled in the Dahlberg, or not this court in Dahlberg, the U.S. Supreme Court in Dahlberg, and this court in Robinson and Gamble.
At what point does this go to the weight and not the admissibility? Isn't that the line we've got to draw? At some point, the jury should be allowed to determine these various components on their own and weigh the measures of them.
So certainly there is a point where you start looking at the weight of the evidence, but the court has drawn the line in Gamble and in Robinson that we initially make a reliability determination and a relevance determination and determine that the expert testimony is relevant before we let this testimony, with the cloak of coming from an expert and having that special status that being expert testimony conveys.
I understand, but we've got case law that says generally this type of analysis goes to the weight and not the admissibility. And how do we square that in this type of case? At what point does it become so attenuated that we have to decide it as a matter of law?
Well, certainly in this case, I think it was for the very simple reason that the testimony in this case and the methodology in this case was focused on something that was not at all the issue before the court. The issue before the court was, and before the jury, was what's the value of this 30-foot by 4,600-foot strip that was over at the backside of the property. And what the expert did was evaluated and gave a value to some other piece of property that wasn't even in the same geographic location. It wasn't reliable to establish the value of that property.
Counsel, in this case, we're coming up 10 years ago, before Daubert. Would you win or lose?
I think 10 years ago, we would win, not necessarily on the same standard, or the same. I think we would win because it wouldn't be reliable testimony, wouldn't be relevant testimony. Obviously, before Daubert, we wouldn't have the gatekeeper hearing, and the issue wouldn't have arisen in that sense. But it wouldn't have been reliable testimony. For example, one of the pieces of testimony dealt with the value of land that was residentially subdivided land. This land is not. The law, even 10 years ago, as reaffirmed in Charbonneau just last May, is that that sort of appraisal is not relevant to unsubdivided land. So
you noticed that we left this issue open in Charbonneau.
Well, it was left open. I think that the general rule I would submit was recognized that existed in Willie, and I think the court left open the possibility that a subdivision development analysis could be performed as sort of a separate, non-comparable theory.
I meant the issue of whether appraisal testimony is screened under Daubert isn't mentioned in the case, although
I think I would suggest, though, in Gamble, the decision was made that all expert testimony is subject to Daubert.
Let me ask you a question, Mr. Heath. It is generally accepted in the appraisal field that one way to appraise property is by the use of comparables. So the appraiser gets up on the stand, and the appraiser says, I appraise this property using comparables. Objection. I want a Robinson hearing. Okay. So the plaintiff, or whoever's proffering the witness, puts the witness back up on the stand and says, Mr. Witness, you're an appraiser, yes, and you've got all the appraiser degrees, yes, you've had all the education an appraiser has, yes, I have, and you've appraised this property, yes, and what methodology did you use? I use the appraisal method. Does that satisfy the Robinson test?
No, I think that doesn't, because the burden is to show that the methodology is reliable. It's not just that the methodology is reliable.
Well, the appraisal methodology, the comparable methodology, is accepted in the industry for appraising property.
That's correct, but you also have to show that the facts that you are looking at and the assumptions that you are looking at correspond to the conclusion that you're making. If we look at, I believe it's Burroughs-Wellcome, I believe is the case, where the antiseptic spray was sprayed on somebody's foot, and the question was, is that testimony reliable because the expert testified that there would be the possibility or it would cause frostbite, assuming there was no discoloration. Turns out there was discoloration. If the facts and the assumptions don't correspond to what you're talking about and what the court has to decide, it's not relevant. In this case, even though the appraisal methodology and the comparable sales methodology is a fine methodology, we don't question that, the assumptions that were made don't correspond to the questions that were before the court. The expert didn't and couldn't connect the dot from A to B, and that's what he has to do.
What should the expert have done in this case to connect the dot from A to B?
Well, I think he had a very difficult problem because his methodology was so flawed. His methodology was, instead of valuing the land that is taken, I'm going to instead give you a valuation for a piece of property, not that's long and skinny, but is compact and roughly square, and not that's located at the back of the property, but that instead is located over by the utilities and on the state highway. And that, I think, that methodology is not reliable for giving us the value of the property that was actually taken.
If he had said that I'm using the appraisal method, what else do you say now is the burden at the Robinson hearing for the plaintiff to get from the witness to establish reliability?
I think he has to show that his assumptions are relevant to the question being answered by the court, or that has to be answered by the jury. So in other words, I think as a general principle, you have to appraise, and I think Charbonneau was very clear in saying that you have to look at and you have to appraise and you have to give an answer about the property that's taken, not some hypothetical, not some speculative piece of property. In Charbonneau, the problem was that the answer was for something that was speculative.
Well, then,
was,
then why isn't this like Charbonneau then in a question of relevancy and not reliability?
Well, I think they are intertwined. I think it is neither reliable nor is it relevant. I think it's not relevant because it's a different piece of property.
But those are two different legal inquiries, and I understand you've hung your hat here on reliability.
Well, I think a methodology is not reliable if it doesn't answer the question that the jury has to answer, if it doesn't address the question that the jury has to answer.
Doesn't that make it irrelevant?
I think in that case,
that to me sounds like relevancy as opposed to reliability.
And I think you cannot separate them in that instance.
Well, what is it? What could the party offering the testimony of this expert have done to make an appropriate record under Robinson that could have established reliability? What is it that you say is missing?
What he could have done is explain how the testimony that he gave got us to the answer the jury was supposed to get to, which is the value of the property that's over at the back end, the property that's taken that's at the back end of the tract. He didn't do that. He didn't connect the dots. He didn't go from A to B.
But you don't think he can.
And I don't think he can. That's correct. Now, I think had he given other testimony, had he had a different methodology, had he had different assumptions, he could have gotten there. But if you start out by saying, I'm not valuing this 4,600-foot piece of property that's three-quarters of a mile from the nearest utility, I'm going to assume that it has utilities, and I'm going to assume that it's sitting on State Highway 123, when in point of fact, it's three-quarters of a mile away. You can't get from A to B in that circumstance. And I think that the methodology was fatally flawed.
Now, Wyndham, let's go to Wyndham was a circumstance where there was a strip of land being taken, and the argument between the parties was how much additional land you have to add to it to create an economic unit that can otherwise be appraised.
Correct.
Neither the landowner nor the condemner used the strip of land. They both appraised that land by adding more land to it to create an economic unit and then using a pro rata share on it, and the argument was just over which more land was to be used. If, in this case, if the appraiser for the landowner had testified that in the comparable method it is appropriate to take the small strip of land that is not able to be valued and add it to other land in order to produce a unit that can be appraised, would he have satisfied Gamble?
Yes.
And but so this evidence would have been reliable and relevant.
If he had done that, but he didn't do that, because what he did was he moved it somewhere else, and his land that he valued did not even include the land actually taken.
So what he needed to testify to was that in the appraisal method, not only is it permissible to include the strip of land in more land in order to get the proper appraisal, but the land has to be at the frontage area, not at the back.
Well, I think you would have to say that the tract that you value and that you use in this pro rata methodology has to include the tract of land taken. Your economic unit has to include the area taken. What he valued was in a different physical location. Page 87 of the transcript says, I moved it, or I assumed it was over on 123. It's not. It's three-quarters of a mile away.
Would it be a fair statement that the example that the appraiser used was a made-up example?
I think it was a made-up methodology.
Did not in any way resemble the piece of land condemned?
Absolutely. It was.
And therefore,
it was,
the premise that he based his whole appraisal on was a faulty one.
Absolutely. It's the difference between this, for example, and Charbonneau is, in Charbonneau,
so
speculative.
So that supports your argument that it's then what he said was neither reliable nor relevant because it didn't appraise the piece of land that was condemned?
Absolutely. In fact, in Gamble, the seatbelt, they said you showed us how this could have happened. You didn't show us that it did happen. You didn't connect the dots to show that it did happen. Here, it never could have happened.
The other point, I think, is the whether you preserved your error that we've been discussing. Is that correct?
That has been raised, and the testimony or the objection was made before the expert testified or gave his opinion that under Robinson and Gamble it was not reliable and that a hearing had to be held.
Okay, thanks.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
The court is ready to hear argument from Ms. Bond.
May it please the court, Mr. Craig Austin will present argument.
May it please the court. First thing I would like to do is
let me ask you a question before you do your first thing.
Sir.
On the preservation thing, it's my understanding that the petitioner points to the record at pages 54 to 56 to show that the objection to your expert's testimony was made timely and sufficient to apprise the trial court of what. Do you agree or disagree with that?
It was made timely. It was a generic objection that could apply from anything to an airplane crash to a zipper. It simply said that the testimony was unreliable because it did not comport with the Daubert concept. Now, that does not tell us wherein it did not comport to the Daubert concept.
But it is no your burden at all when that's raised to show that it is both reliable and relevant?
It is our responsibility, but when all is said and done, if the other party has specific objections, the objection must be specifically made. A generic objection is insufficient.
Okay, thank you.
At the outset of this, I would like to take issue with my opposing counsel's statement that the issue is whether the Daubert rule applies. Quite plainly, by its terms, the Daubert rule applies. The difficulty comes in the fact that the Daubert rule was basically enunciated to exclude pseudoscience. That is, to give the judge, apparently regarded as a person with superior knowledge and intellect.
But what about Gamble? Doesn't Gamble take the issue way beyond junk science and say basically that Rule 702's reliance and relevant factors apply to any expert?
Yes, and we're in complete agreement with that.
Why wouldn't it apply to an appraiser in a condemnation case?
We do not have any quarrel with the proposition that it applies to appraisal testimony. The problem is that the rule as enunciated was intended for pseudoscience.
I know, but then Gamble say we're going to have cases where the, quote, the five factors in Robinson or the six factors in Texas and the five factors in federal cases will not fit.
This is
a
one
trial court's analysis.
This
but
is
that
one
still doesn't mean you're not supposed to do one, is it?
Well, for example, the Daubert rule requires that the opinion of the appraiser be subjected to concurrent review by his peers
adaptable to that. Well, do you say that you think you have to apply that factor here or that it's not a necessary one and let's look to something
else?
That's
exactly the argument I am making, that when you try to fit a size 12 appraisal into a size 9 Daubert configuration.
But I'm still not, that doesn't mean you're not supposed to do an analysis to determine whether it's relevant.
Well, you should do it. You should do it the best you can. But an appraisalist of the value of real estate is a radically different expert opinion than whether silicone causes breast cancer. I think the Daubert rule is predicated upon the responsibility of the judge to protect the jury from pseudoscientific testimony.
I'm not understanding what the basis of your argument is. If you agree that theory applies, why doesn't this case require such an analysis? And if it does, what kind of analysis do you think the trial court should have done?
Well, it does, Your Honor. It does apply, and it does require an analysis. The difference is that a valuation opinion as to land has nothing to do with science or pseudoscience.
Well, let's say we all agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's not an issue with the court. What should be done when that objection is made and a request for a Daubert hearing is made within the context of a condemnation case and the appraiser's proposed testimony?
What was done was properly done by Judge Rodriguez, the trial judge in this case. She took the Daubert standard, put it up against the testimony that was offered, and then made the best decision that she could under the circumstances that she had. And, you know, this is a matter strictly within the discretion of the trial court. The judge, I think it must be presumed, and the evidence bears out, did the best job that she could in trying to fit the Daubert rule to an appraisal testimony.
Mr. Austin, as I understand Mr. Heath's argument, he claims that under Gammel, that there is an analytical gap in the expert's testimony, and that is that by reconfiguring the property before doing the comparative, the comparison with other properties, that by doing that, then there was no nexus between that type of analysis and the actual facts in this case, and that is fatal, that Gammel, in fact, requires that there be that nexus in order to avoid analytical gaps that are fatal to an expert's opinion. Would you respond to that argument, please?
Yes, I will. The fact is, in this particular case, there were no open market sales of rights-of-way, strip rights-of-way in Guadalupe County, Texas. So neither party had direct comparables that they could apply to that equation. Obviously, there were two alternatives. The plaintiff, the landowner, relied upon the reconfiguration into a unit that was economic. On the other hand, the condemnor's appraiser wanted it to be 350 seconds of the value of the mother tract. Now, this is very unfair to the landowner, because it is the state. It is the arbitrary action of the state. Let me reverse the word arbitrary. It is the considered judgment of the state or the Guadalupe River Authority that they need a tract of land 30 feet wide and 4,600 feet long. By that determination of convenience and necessity, the River Authority cast upon the landowner the burden of accepting that strange configuration.
Well, but then if the complaint is that there's an analytical gap,
mm-hmm.
because there's no nexus between the reconfiguration and the actual facts in the case, then wasn't it incumbent upon you in offering the expert to show that that was an accepted methodology within the appraisal industry to do that type of reconfiguration? And if so, then there is nothing in the record that indicates that, to my understanding.
Well, there is, because we call to the attention the textbook, which is widely accepted in Texas, Rayburn and Condemnation, that was supportive of our position. Now, on the other hand, you will see in your briefs in this court a quotation from the American Institute of Appraisal.
Well, let's go back to what the record says. What is specifically in the record that shows that this reconfiguration approach as part of the methodology for doing a comparable sales analysis is accepted in the appraisal industry?
In the record, I believe there is some mention of the Wyndham case and also Rayburn on Condemnation.
But do you agree that having done this reconfiguration, which you say was required by the circumstance because there was no other way to do comparable sales, that the line of cases interpreting Rule 702 would require that there be proof that this was an accepted methodology in order to be reliable? Do you agree with that?
Well, yes, and I think that we offered sufficient proof in the form of an outside source.
Okay, and what does the record reflect that this secondary material by Rayburn, what does it reflect? Does it support and show that this reconfiguration approach was an accepted methodology within the industry?
Oh, we know that the reconfiguration approach, at least within the situations that have so far presented themselves, is quite acceptable under Texas law. Now, on the other hand,
relying on Wyndham for that?
Yes, we do, Your Honor. We rely on Wyndham for that.
You're relying on Wyndham as the legal basis for approaching that. My question is whether or not, and that depends on our interpretation of Wyndham, my question still goes back to, does Rayburn, if that's what you rely upon in the record, reflect the fact that doing this type of reconfiguration as part of the methodology on a comparative sales analysis show that it is an accepted method within the industry?
Well, to my thinking, it does. It requires a lot of inference. Let me point out this. There was a swearing match between two appraisers. One appraiser said, I did it the right way, and the other said, no, I did it the right way. We offered the only outside evidence of procedure within the law or within the industry. Now, I noticed before the Supreme Court, they have used for the first time a quotation from a publication of the American Institute of Appraisers, the Appraisal Institute. This is highly respected, of course, but this did not appear in the trial court. It did not appear in the Court of Appeals. It appears for the first time in the Supreme Court. So, essentially, when the judge has a swearing match between two experts, then all she can do is rely upon their respective testimony. And unless she has some guidance from a third source, which I believe the Dahlberg rule specifically anticipates, then the judge has to do the best she can on what she hears. And there was no evidence introduced, no standards introduced that would, from the outside, that would contradict either of these appraisers' testimonies.
Mr. Austin, could a court just in an appraisal real estate and just realize that what the appraisers say are subjective, could the court just decide that I'm hearing two experts, this is a strip of land, narrow strip of land at the back end of some property that's several hundred acres, that's a couple hundred acres large, and the strip is at the back of that, very little frontage road on a four-lane highway. And the owner buys it for $100,000, and we're here 3 years later, we're still in the country, the basic use of the land hasn't changed, and there's an argument between the appraisers as to whether this strip of land is worth $2,100 an acre or it's worth, $20,000 an acre. And the judge looks, gosh, if I take one witness, that whole property's worth $6 million, or this witness, it's only worth $500,000. Could a judge just listen to the witness's testimony between two appraisers and just from the judge's own knowledge of the community and real estate values just determine one appraiser is just out the window?
Yes. And that's what she did.
How does your economic unit, which is fairly hypothetical, differ from what we talked about in Charbonneau?
Yes.
With the hypothetical subdivision? How do you distinguish those two?
Well, in my opinion, I think that there needs to be a second look taken at this problem. Obviously, when you have a government carrying out a proprietary function, they're out to make money, and the strip of right-of-way is a link in a chain of a valuable pipeline that has a value in and of itself. So, in the broader philosophical sense, yes, it is an economic unit, and it would not be taken and used if it were not an economic unit in the broader sense. In this case, the testimony was to the contrary.
Well, I'm still trying to link up the difference between the hypothetical subdivision in Charbonneau and your hypothetical economic unit here.
Well, I think I can assist you in that respect. We have had a long history in Texas of landowners trying to create hypothetical subdivisions and losing in the courts because they did try to create hypothetical subdivisions. Now, what the appraiser in Charbonneau did was to take a piece of land and to say, well, now, if we develop this land, we can sell all of this land for X number of dollars. And then we back out the hypothetical profit, and therefore we give the landowner the hypothetical, you back out the hypothetical cost, and then give the landowner the hypothetical profit. I knew that case was headed for reversal because, well, that may be the law in some states. It's certainly not in Texas.
But didn't you do the same thing here? You took a hypothetical configuration that wasn't this configuration. You compared it to a hypothetical close to a highway that's not close to a highway. I mean, I'm trying to figure out the difference between the hypotheticals here.
Well, look, the difference is this. This case is unique, like all pipeline cases, like all strip right-of-way cases, because the configuration is imposed at the pleasure and for the pure convenience of the government. Now, we all know, and this is probably the strongest factor in the valuation of real estate, that a small acreage, 3 acres, is going to sell for much, much more than a large acreage, 247. Now, if the landowner is tied to the average value concept, he is going to be compelled to make a sale under very disadvantageous positions, under force of condemnation, when if he sold that same strip in the open market, he would get the small acreage price. And so the objective of the appraiser was to give him the small acreage price in this case, and the only way he could do it was by virtue of a reconfiguration.
The Court of Appeals quotes from Rayburn in its opinion. Is there any other section of Rayburn that's in the record that's not in the Court of Appeals opinion?
Would you repeat your question, Jim?
The Court of Appeals opinion quotes Rayburn. Are there any other sections of Rayburn that were offered to the trial court that don't appear in the Court of Appeals opinion?
No. No, there were not. No, you see, the problem is that there are several elements of comparability, one of which is configuration, and one of which is size. Well, size is highly important. A 3-acre tract is quite valuable. Comparability should be disregarded entirely, or at least severely downgraded, where the buyer has the power by virtue of the exercise of governmental concepts of eminent domain to impose whatever configuration that the buyer wants.
Well, let me ask you this, then, under that theory, would this reconfiguration land be worth more or less if it didn't have utilities?
It would be worth more if it has utilities, yes.
Would it be worth less if it didn't have them?
Yes, it would.
Would it be worth more or less if it was not on the highway?
Depends on which highway and what the purpose is. If you're talking about Highway 123, it would be worth more for commercial reasons. It would be worth less for residential reasons. And the highest and best use in this case was ultimately for residential.
But is property on a highway worth more than property that's not on a highway?
Yes, depending on the purpose. If you have a commercial purpose, obviously.
What about this pure access?
Well, this case had good. This particular tract had good access on 2 paved roads, one to the north, one to the south. So
but
there's
no
question.
What about where the strip?
Yes,
was?
That's what I mean. The strip had access to 2 paved roads, one on the north, one on the south.
Well, if you took away some of these elements that the appraiser put into this reconfigured piece of 3-acre land, wouldn't that change its value?
Oh, yes. Emphasizing one or erasing one, yes, that always changes
the value. Well, what I'm trying to get at, when you take the factors that he used for this reconfigured piece of land and compare them to the factors of the land that's being condemned, there's a pretty broad difference between those two.
Oh, yes, and there's a great difference between this 3-acre-long strip and the 247-acre mother strip out of which it was taken.
I know, but isn't the purpose of the comparable sale theory of appraisals to get a comparable sales to the piece of property being condemned.
Yes, it is, but there are no comparable sales of strips in Guadalupe County, Texas.
Is there a law that says you're limited to the county for looking for comparables?
No, I suppose that you could go as far as you wanted to. It strains credibility. But basically, the
appraisal... Well, the idea of a comparable sale to get a sale that's as close as possible to the condemned land to make the comparison a valid one?
Yes, but this is where the process of eminent domain in and of itself clouds the issue. Because no landowner in his right mind is going to sell that 3-acre strip across the center of his property for a prorated portion of what the entire property is worth.
So, well, but our law still says that even under those adverse circumstances, what the landowner is entitled to is the reasonable fair market value of whatever's condemned in that right and whatever loss there may be to the remainder.
Well, let's make this assumption. You go into an art supply house, you buy three pounds of modeling clay. They charge you 50 cents a pound for it. The value for a 100-pound sack is $6. That's the difference. Because the state can take this right-of-way that they've acquired, and they want to acquire it at the wholesale price and form it into any shape they wish to form it, whether the landowner likes it or not. Now, if he's selling 3 acres, Your Honor, the landowner is entitled to the 3-acre price.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
The issue before the jury in this case is what is the value of the land taken, and that's what has to be answered. I think it is clear from the record in this case that the expert testimony that was offered by the landowner did not address that issue. It wasn't relevant. It wasn't reliable. And it, as we have talked about it today, we've talked about the Wyndham situation, the possibility of reconfiguring. And reconfiguring land by adding additional land to take an economic, to develop an economic unit, because this was not an economic unit. And the testimony by the landowner's expert was that it was not a unit, it had no value at all in the that configuration. You can add land to it and develop a configuration that is an economic unit, as was done in Wyndham. And we could argue whether it ought to be the entire 273-acre tract of land, or maybe 100 acres or 50 acres or something, but it would contain the land taken and it would go to the value of the land taken.
Do you agree that there were no comparable sales with that sort of configuration?
There were no sales of that specific, you know, there were no long pipeline type easement sales.
So how is an appraiser, and maybe the secondary materials say this, is reconfiguration an option for an expert appraiser?
What the appropriate methodology, we believe, which is the one that was discussed at Wyndham and which both experts used at Wyndham, is that you take the property, add property to it to develop an economic unit. And once you get that economic unit, then you appraise it, determine what the value of that is, and take a pro rata share of that. So in this case, if it's a 100-acre tract, you can determine what that 100 acres would sell for. This was 3.21 acres, be 3.21% of what the 100 acres would sell for. And that's what was done in Wyndham. There's a lot of discussion in Wyndham, as was appropriate, as to whether it ought to be, I think it was a 19-acre tract versus a 60-acre tract or whatever it happened to be.
But that's the only way to do it. Are there materials in Rayburn or anywhere else where the process used by this expert, the one that's the subject of this appeal, where a reconfiguration is done and then a valuation?
I am aware of nothing which would permit reconfiguration of the property and moving it to a different site so it's a different property. I know of nothing that would permit that.
Mr. Heath, I may be mistaken. As I understand Texas law, a landowner can testify in a condemnation suit about the value of the property that's being taken.
Yes, Your Honor.
How does that square with Gamble and Robinson?
That testimony is not 702 expert testimony. It doesn't come in with the same sort of aura and imprimatur that expert testimony comes in.
But nothing under current law would preclude that rule from still applying and allowing a landowner to get on the stand and say, I think that my property is worth X dollars.
Right, and the jury could take that for what it's worth, but it's not going to be worth the same thing as a trained appraiser, as the landowner's expert was. I mean, we didn't question his qualifications, we questioned his methodology. In this case, the only evidence supporting the jury verdict was the testimony of Mr. Goulson, the landowner's expert. It was unreliable. It should have been excluded. And there was no evidence to support that verdict. The only remaining evidence in the record is that offered by the River Authority's expert. And we would urge that the court reverse the Court of Appeals and render judgment or direct the district court.
I have a final question, Mr. Heath. The witness says he uses comparables. Did he need to say that in doing comparables it is permissible to take the narrow strip of land and reconfigure it to an economic unit and then compare it to other property that size? And if he had said that, would the court have been required to accept his testimony or allow his testimony to be admitted?
If he had taken that and had made it into an economic unit by adding land that included that?
No, by reconfiguring it. Just as happened in this case, Mr. Goulson on the Robinson hearing said that to do a comparable, it is permissible to take the land and reconfigure it in order to create an economic unit to compare with others. That's permissible in the appraisal method. Would the court have been obligated to admit this testimony?
I think the acceptable in the appraisal method, it would have to have included the land, so it would have been to create a larger economic unit containing it.
But how does the court know, when he says he reconfigured it rather than adding land, that somehow defeats the methodology part of the scientific method so that the court could not keep that testimony out?
Well, in this case, it's very clear on page 87 and 88 of the transcript. He said not only did he reconfigure it, but he moved it to a different part of the property and put it on the highway, on Highway 123, when it was three quarters of a mile.
Well, maybe I'm not being clear. Taking just what you said, if he had said that in the Robinson hearing, that is an appropriate way to do the appraisal method, would the court have to have admitted the testimony?
I think the court has to make a judgment as to whether that is a reliable methodology. As this court has said in, I believe, Gamble and other cases, just because the expert says it so doesn't make it so. The district court has a gatekeeper function to determine if that is an appropriate methodology.
Mr. Heath, in Charbonneau, when we agreed with the city of Harlingen, we remanded the case to the trial court. If we agree with you in this case, is that also the appropriate disposition, a remand?
I think you can render in this case. In that case, that was not actually a, that was a trial before the court. In this case, I think the appropriate remedy is to render at least remand with instructions that a judgment be entered in the amount of the evidence in the record, which is something like $7,000.
And that's the testimony that your client offered.
That's correct.
Well, but that still requires a fact-finding on the part of the jury, because the jury is not obligated to accept what your expert said. So how could we render, in light of the fact that the jury always has the discretion in hearing the testimony, to weigh it and determine whether it's appropriate or not?
Well, that was the only testimony that was in the record.
Well, I understand, but we're precluded from doing fact-finding.
Sure.
Wouldn't we be required to do that if we rendered? Wouldn't we be doing some fact-finding? We would be accepting that testimony and determining if that was the appropriate amount to be paid as compensation.
Well, it would be undisputed testimony on our part, certainly.
Well, I understand, but even undisputed testimony is always subject to the jury deciding what weight to give to it. Correct?
Well, we know the jury gave at least some weight and gave, determined that there was a higher value. I think you can assume.
I understand, but do you see my problem in
right.
terms of a render?
I see your argument. Yes. Yes.
Okay. So your position still is that we should render?
We would urge you to render.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the first call. The court will take a brief recess.
All rise.